Scott Elliott, AP Senate AO. The biography by O'Byrne gives scant information on how Desmond Leslie came to realize there was a connection between the esoteric tradition and UFOs. In 1951, Leslie visited an unnamed friend and found the copy of The Story of Atlantis, 1896, by W. Scott Elliott. In this book he was fascinated by a reference to the Vimanas of Atlantis, who are described as made of a metal of extreme lightness and strength. These craft shone in the dark as if coated with luminous paint. It was an intriguing book, and while reading it I sensed something familiar. Certain characteristics were described there which tallied almost identically with the United States Army's flying saucer reports of today. I began to think, and wonder. What perhaps Desmond Leslie didn't realize at the time was that The Story of Atlantis was a joint effort by W. Scott Elliott and theosophist Charles Leadbeater. This discovery entered a period of intense research by Leslie to find references to aircraft in ancient manuscripts. He spent many hours at the British Museum studying the Hindu epics Ramayana and Mahabharata, where he found many references to aerial vehicles. He read the classics in Theosophy and Alice Bailey and eventually started corresponding with Mead Lane, founder of Borderland Sciences Research Associates, BSRA, in 1945. From Mead Lane he was informed of George Adamski's meeting with a pilot from a flying saucer. Desmond Leslie wrote to Adamski, was offered his photos free of charge, and the rest in history. Flying Saucers Have Landed was published by T. Wernerlory, London, in September 1953. In June 1954, Desmond Leslie headed off to California to meet George Adamski. Leslie had intended to stay for a month but stayed on for nearly 3 months. He was 33 at the time and Adamski 63, but they got along very well together, and for Leslie the visit was a joyful and a success in all ways except one. He had hoped to be allowed a trip in one of the scout ships photographed by Adamski, but this never happened and he complained rather bitterly at the time. Many years later Adamski explained why Leslie was not allowed on board to his co-work Luzinstag. "You know, they once planned to take aboard a young friend of mine whom I very much wanted to be favored. But they tested this man in secrecy and found out that he was still too young to keep a secret." In his commentary on George Adamski, published in the revised and enlarged edition of Flying Saucers Have Landed, 1970, Leslie found this a wise decision. Noticing how publicity and illusions of grandeur have ruined the lives of several alleged contactees, he concludes, "Vanity lurks skin deep in most of us. The eager crowds, the silly adulators, the hungry sheep seeking some new stimulus, the temptation to be the great I am, I might well have become the worst of the lot." During his stay with Adamski, Leslie did observe a small golden disc not more than 50 feet away. Desmond Leslie with George Adamski in 1954. During the 1950s, Desmond Leslie was intensively involved with the UFO movement. He lectured all over the world and was interviewed on many radio and TV programs. But he also continued his study of the esoteric tradition and paranormal phenomena like materializations, visiting various spiritualist mediums who could produce what is named ectoplasm. Leslie claimed to have witnessed at least 40 complete materializations in the presence of many witnesses. In an appendix to the Leslie biography, Herbie Brennan relates an interesting experience. Desmond had participated in a seance with the famous materialization medium Alexander Alec Harris. The spirits walked into the room where they would talk with the sitters. Leslie was convinced this was some sort of fraud with accomplices dressed up and decided to expose the fraud. Desmond leapt from his seat and grabbed one by the arm. "I was never so surprised in my life. The creature simply dissolved under my hand and disappeared." One of the reasons critical ufologists regarded George Adamski and other 1950s contactees as frauds was their assertion that the visitors come from planets in our solar system, especially Venus. But although Adamski himself and the present Adamski movement still claim that Venus is inhabited by physical beings like ourselves, Desmond Leslie never really accepted this assertion and argued heavily with Adamski on this issue. He tried to explain his view in commentary on George Adamski in the new edition of Flying Saucers Have Landed, where he presented the esoteric explanation that Venus is inhabited but not in our visible of the multiverse. The esoteric explanation to Adamski's Venusians was presented already in 1952 by Borderlands Sciences Research Association. This information was given clairaudiently to the remakeable medium Mark Probert commenting on the Contact November 20, 1952, there. Story is in the main true. The disc did land and Mr. Adamski did carry on a conversation with the operator of said ship. But Brother Adamski was so excited he does not remember clearly all that was said. This particular ship was from the planet Venus. We would like to remind you, however, that the intense heat on that body, due to its proximity to the Sun and an atmosphere heavy with carbon dioxide, make it highly unlikely or impossible that beings with the same organic structure as Earth, man could abide on its surface. The Venus beings live in the ether of this planet. Journal of Borderland Research, Jan, February 1972, p. 20. Venusian scout ship photographed by George Adamski, December 13, 1952. From the many references and quotes from various esoteric authors in Flying Saucers Have Landed and many subsequent articles, it is obvious that Desmond Leslie was very well versed regarding the esoteric tradition. This made him realize there was a great similarity between the worldview of the space people and esotericism. In a letter to George Adamski co. worker Carol Honey October 14, 1962, he wrote, "The teachings of the brothers are acceptable because they tally, agree, with the teachings of that band of initiates and sages who through all history preserved the divine law and released to the world in every age as much as they considered advisable to the relatively simple children they tried to help. With his deep commitment to the more intellectual or academic esotericism, it comes as quite a surprise that Desmond Leslie around 1960 began studying the teachings of the spiritualist group the White Eagle Lodge, founded by Grace and Ivan Cook in 1936. A traditional spiritualist group very much engaged in healing and teachings which are more mysticism than esotericism. One of the reasons may have been that Grace Cook, according to Leslie, already in the 1930s had predicted the coming of the space people. In an article, The Rise and Fall of UFO Societies, for the magazine Awareness, published by Contact UK, Spring 1968, Desmond Leslie writes, 30 years ago they first received information as to the impending coming of the space people. They have never swerved from the light, nor from the guidance given them. If Desmond Leslie had carefully studied the works of Alice Bailey, he would have found the same information presented in a somewhat different form. So can we, like religious scholar Robert Elwood, define Desmond Leslie as an esotericist, in spite of his endorsement of the White Eagle Lodge teachings? I would answer in the affirmative. White Eagle Lodge functioned like Leslie's church as he left the Catholic Church, but his worldview was clearly esoteric. This becomes obvious in his position statement in the Encyclopedia of UFOs, 1980, edited by Ronald D. Story. The UFO problem is vastly more complex than I first thought it was. Many are undoubtedly interplanetary probes from other systems. Some of the odder sightings are not of spacecraft but of psychic and spiritual phenomena. He then refers to the theosophist Geoffrey Hodgson, postulating that some UFOs could be devas or elementals. Desmond Leslie was a pioneer in the controversial and fascinating underground world of ufology. I admire his searching spirit and his wonderful humor. Some years before his death in 2001, a guidebook to Ireland had described his family as mildly eccentric. Leslie wrote to the publishers explaining that the Leslies were in fact very eccentric. Riley Crabb, UFOs and Theosophy. Between 1979, 1985 I corresponded with Riley Crabb, director of Borderland Sciences Research Foundation, BSRF, and editor of the Journal of Borderland Research 1959, 1985. Riley became sort of a mentor in my research and study of UFOs, paranormal phenomena, theosophy and the many offshoots of the esoteric tradition. We didn't always agree, but I valued his extensive knowledge and experience in many borderland areas, and he sometimes printed my articles in his always interesting and controversial journal. I was very surprised when I learned that in 1986 there were only 450 subscribers worldwide to the BSRF journal. At that time we had around 3,000 subscribers to UFO, Aktuellt, published by UFO, Sweden. There was one domain where Riley and I definitely clashed in opinions: the writings and theories of John Keel and Jacques Vallée. As a young ufologist in the 1970s, I was deeply inspired by Keel and Vallée and could never really understand why Riley Crabb didn't appreciate the merits of these authors and constantly criticized their writings in the BSRF journal. In a letter to me March 23, 1980, he writes, "John Keel has been discussed at length in the journal in the past. He is a wilderness crying for a voice, and I've told him so. His writings, like those of Jacques Vallée, leave one hopeless. Their general conclusion is that the flying saucer phenomenon is beyond understanding. It's the creation of malevolent forces here on the Earth. There's nothing we can do about it. There is no inspirational lift from Keel and Vallée, and there can't be because the two men aren't even metaphysical kindergartners. They are metaphysical illiterates." This, in my view, was a very one-sided view of the groundbreaking research and writings of Keel and Vallée. How come that an esotericist like Riley Crabb couldn't see that these authors expanded our horizon and looked beyond the materialist, reductionist interpretation of the UFO phenomenon? True, none of them were esotericists in the theosophical tradition, but at least Vallée was well-versed in Hermeticism and other esoteric traditions. Neither was Keel the metaphysical illiterate portrayed by Crabb, something I mentioned in a recent blog. We never resolved this issue, and after much discussion Riley Crabb gave up and wrote in an undated letter 1981, "But if you find comfort and inspiration in the writings and conclusions of these two men, by all means stay with them." Riley Crabb became interested in borderland sciences when in 1934 he discovered the large library in the Theosophical Society in Minneapolis. Together with his wife Judy, he lived 13 years in Hawaii and was for 3 years president of the Honolulu Lodge of the Theosophical Society. During his stay in Hawaii, he also studied pagan magic at first hand from native kahunas. Mr. and Mrs. Crabb moved to California in 1957, where Riley worked as a visual information specialist for the U.S. Navy's Pacific Missile Range, PT, Mugu, California. Having been a member of Mead Lane's BSRA since 1951, he decided in 1959 to give up his job and took over as director of BSRA, later Borderland Sciences Research Foundation, BSRF. A position he held until 1985. I've always admired his ambition and motto presented in the first editorial July, August 1959 under the headline, "About the New Editor." "Since coming to the mainland, my lectures have been concerned with the problem of relating flying saucer data, and phenomena, to the teachings of the mystery schools. I believe you will agree this is no easy task. If I have one goal in life, it is an uncompromising search for truth, whatever that might be, and wherever it may lead." The Journal of Borderland Research is a treasure trove of unusual data and theories. Riley Crabb always presented interesting and challenging views on many subjects. Maybe he was a little too naive or open-minded when accepting channeled information from various sources, but he still printed, May, June 1981, "My Very Critical Review of Briefing for the Landing on Planet Earth," by Stuart Holroyd. More and more I have come to appreciate his political left-wing comments in the journal. Comments he often received harsh criticism for. But he was very well aware of the dangers from the ever-growing corporatocracy and would have loved Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. A book that should be studied by all people interested in world politics and economic history. For many years, Riley Crabb tried to awaken leading theosophists to the importance of the UFO phenomenon, without much success. Looking back on these efforts in a letter to Flying Saucer Review editor Gordon Creighton on August 5, 1990, he wrote, It is now obvious to me that one of my major reasons for being here in New Zealand is to try to awaken the leaders of the Theosophical Lodges to the realities of other inhabited planets and of advanced beings from them, quoting their own earliest literature. When I quoted the early literature on space travel to Joy Mills, one of the leading American Theosophists at Crotona, Ojai, California, she replied that the references were allegorical, ha. She also quoted Jung on UFOs in his book, that the spacecraft were images in the race mind. Riley's wife Judy died on July 12, 1985. It is heartbreaking to read his last letter to me April 6, 1985, where he gives a very realistic picture of all the daily practical problem he is confronted with while nursing his dying wife. But life soon changed to the better. Riley Crabb moved to New Zealand after his wife's death, where he found a new love and married Phyllis Hall. They continued Theosophical and Borderland work together, and he also published some booklets from NZ, like Theosophy on the Space Age. He died in 1994. Gordon Creighton and the FSR Archives. This Christmas holiday I spent 2 days unpacking the extensive Flying Saucer Review archive graciously donated to AFU by Edwin Joyce. The collection now occupy 35 shelves in one of our premises. We are very grateful and happy to have been chosen as the custodians of this exceedingly valuable collection. Unfortunately, the material is rather disorganized. Many boxes contained a chaotic combination of clippings, correspondence, articles and UFO reports. Sorting this out will not be easy, as Gordon Creighton often put together various items with 8 or 10 small staples which now have become rusty and difficult to remove. But the collection is a historical treasure trove of data. Clis Farn has, as usual, been the principal negotiator with Edwin Joyce regarding this donation. It has taken more than 10 years to convince Edwin that AFU is the best option for preserving the FSR archive. Clis regard these discussions as one of his foremost achievements in his persistent efforts to save valuable international collections. I agree. From what I have been able to estimate, doing a basic survey, the oldest material is from the 1960s. The first generation FSR archives are lost forever due to the wives of editors Waveney Gervin and Charles Bowen. At a meeting with Jacques Vallee in 1970, Charles Bowen lamented the situation. At the death of Waveney Gervin, our first editor, he said tearfully, there was nothing left of the Flying Saucer Review. The archives, the files, even the collection had disappeared. Gervin's wife disposed of them. She hated the whole subject. Just like my wife. Jacques Vallee, Forbidden Science, Volume 2, p. 22. A good reminder to all ufologists and 14s out there, whether male or female, to brief your prospective partner of your strange, outsider interests, before falling in love. In a letter to Timothy Good, August 8, 1985, Gordon Creighton commented on the sad history of the FSR archives. There are no FSR archives for 1957, anyway. I have never seen any or been able to trace any. Nor do there seem to be any for the period before I took over from Bowen, for none has come to me. I think it is an astounding state of affairs, worthy of much comment. In Bowen's case, I am sure it is due to his wife's deep hostility to the subject and the need for a tidy house. When Waveney Gervin died, I made a dash there to rescue what I could of the archives, but got virtually nothing. The wife, deeply hostile to the subject, had probably burned it all. Gordon Creighton, 1908-2003. Was the editor of Flying Saucer Review from 1982. Between 1964 and 1982, Charles Bowen and Gordon Creighton cooperated in making FSR one of the most successful UFO magazines in history, attracting the best minds in the field. Bowen and Creighton were heavily influenced by the new ufology of John Keel and Jacques Vallee in the 1970s. But unfortunately, this influence resulted in a more and more paranoid and religiously orthodox interpretation of the phenomenon. This became very evident when Gordon Creighton assumed editorship in 1982. In Dark Apocalyptic Visions, he constantly warned readers of the demonic influence coming from the UFO entities. In spite of this new ideological trend, many of the old ufologists and correspondents kept supporting FSR. Gordon Creighton. UFOs as demons was of course not a new idea. It had been propagated by fundamentalist Christians since the 1950s. It also influenced leading British ufologists in Bfora. As told by David Clark and Andy Roberts in the excellent Flying Sorcerers, A Social History of Ufology, Graham Stubb and Roger Stanway resigned from Bfora as they had become convinced that UFOs had satanic origins. Field investigator Randall Jones Pugh built a bonfire in his garden and burned all his UFO and occult books. In an interview, he claimed that smoke billowed up in the form of a human being, and two hands began to reach out. He was scared out of his wits. Clark and Roberts, 134-135. In his FSR editorial, Volume 28, Number 6, published in August 1983, Gordon Creighton made this confession. To conclude on a more personal note, it might at this point be right to add that the present editor has known since June 1957 what the UFO entities are, but has been at some pains not to let this fact color his contributions. But in the next issue of FSR, Volume 29, Number 1, he let the cat, demons, out of the bag with his article A Brief Account of the True Nature of the UFO Entities. From this article it becomes evident that Gordon Creighton derived much of his basic ideas on UFOs from Rudolf Steiner, founder of the Anthroposophical movement. According to Anthroposophists, UFOs are manifestations of the demonic Ahriman. The other enemy of mankind is called Lucifer. This was probably what Creighton discovered in 1957, as ideas from Anthroposophy colored many of the articles in earlier FSR issues. Not surprisingly, as between 1965-1974 Dan Lloyd was assistant editor of FSR. Dan Lloyd and his wife Eileen were leading anthroposophists in Britain. In an article, Let's Take Off Our Blinkers, in FSR, Volume 15, Number 1, January, February 1969, Dan Lloyd writes, "What, then, it may well be asked, are the physical manifestations of UFOs, that are so widely reported? In order to answer this question, it should be known that there are on this earth other spiritual beings whose intention it is to prevent mankind following its true evolution. These beings, also known as the lying spirits, are in the service of the cosmic being who has been known since ancient Persian times as Ahriman. In the Bible he is known as Satan." Ideas like these are now very popular in ufology, and there are more and more books on UFOs as jinns or demons. What a pity that old Gordon didn't instead consider the more balanced interpretations of various phenomena presented by classic esotericists like Helena P. Blavatsky and Alice Bailey. But of course, the iconoclast Blavatsky called her journal Lucifer, not approved of by Christian mystic Rudolf Steiner. "Speak of the devil and he will appear," is an old phrase. If Gordon Creighton had taken this adage to his heart, his editorials and articles would probably not have been so paranoid, looking for demons everywhere. This reminds me of a passage in the classic A Dictionary of Angels, Including the Fallen Angels, 1967, by Gustav Davidson. He spent years collecting data for his dictionary, corresponding with scholars and theologians. As angels and devils was constantly on his mind for years, he made an interesting discovery: we create what we believe. This became very evident in many ways to Gustav Davidson. He writes in the introduction, "I remember one occasion, it was winter and getting dark, returning home from a neighboring farm, I had cut across an unfamiliar field. Suddenly a nightmarish shape loomed up in front of me, barring my progress. After a paralyzing moment, I managed to fight my way past the phantom. The next morning I could not be sure whether I had encountered a ghost, an angel, a demon, or God. At this stage of the quest I was literally bedeviled by angels. They stalked and leaked me, by night and day. I could not tell the evil from the good, demons from devas, satans from seraphim. I moved, indeed, in the twilight zone of tall presences. I felt somewhat like Dante, in the opening canto of the Divine Comedy." Gordon Creighton was a fascinating ufologist, erudite linguist and in several ways a remarkable man. His correspondence with people from all over the world is now preserved at AFU. This important collection will be of interest to scholars, historians, ufologists and fortines for years to come. But it will take us at AFU many months of work before his archive is in order. Earth, an alien enterprise. One of the failures of the scientifically oriented ufologists of the 1950s and 60s was neglecting to thoroughly investigate and document the first generation contactees and their experiences. George Adamski, Daniel Fry, Orfeo Angelosi, George Van Tassel, Howard Mengreo. By dismissing them as charlatans and mystics, lots of interesting data was lost. Open-minded contactee research was not regarded as scientifically respectable by organizations like APRO and NICAP. This ideological trend began to change in the 1970s with the books and theories of Jacques Vallée and John Keel. Based on years of field investigation, they concluded that the contactee enigma was far more complicated and intriguing than a simple black and white issue. In spite of the research of Keel and Vallée, there were no serious efforts to take a second look at the classic contactees. The first ufologists to accept the challenge was Timothy Goode, who in 1984, together with Lou Zinsdag, published George Adamski, The Untold Story. This book presented lots of new data and reopened the Adamski case. Since then, Timothy Goode has continued his investigations of contactee cases, resulting in bestsellers like Alien Base, 1998. Earth, an Alien Enterprise is the recently published book by Timothy Goode, a massive tome of 466 pages. In this is a sequel to Alien Base with documentation of contactee cases combined with several chapters detailing the claims of various whistleblowers, including some inside sources from the intelligence community. Chapter 11, The Overlords, is a summary of the Richard Hoagland case, which I have documented in my book, Aliens on Earth. UFO Contacts in Sweden. Many of the contactee cases mentioned have been published before, but Timothy Goode add much new interesting information, often from personal interviews and correspondence. One such example is the Leo Dorshak case. Timothy visited Leo and his wife in their home in Montana in 2004. Somewhat more problematic are the chapters documenting the many rumors and stories relating interaction and liaison between military officials, politicians, Kennedy and Eisenhower, and presumed space people. In these cases, we usually have no possibility of checking sources. All we can say is, interesting if true. Here I would advocate a more critical attitude. Secret intelligence sources are notoriously unreliable. Much of this data could simply be disinformation and cover stories for various black projects. One chapter is devoted to the exceedingly complicated and controversial Amicizia case from Italy. The most extraordinary case I have ever investigated. But Timothy Goode also admits that it is outrageous, farcical, and ludicrous. His book is dedicated for Professor Stefano Brescia, 1945-2012, whom he interviewed on several occasions in Brescia's home in Italy. Stefano Brescia is the author of Mass Contacts, 2009, and 50 Years of Amicizia, Friendship, edited by ufologist Warren P. Aston, 2013. As I have explained to Timothy Goode in our correspondence, this is a case of which I am rather doubtful. According to Edoardo Russo in Italy, his group CISA has thoroughly investigated the Amicizia story and are very adamant that this is a complicated hoax involving many people in Italy, a dark page of Italian ufology. Unfortunately, they have not published the extensive CISU documentation, which I hope they will do in the near future. As we have two totally opposite views on this case, it is difficult for an outsider to form any clear opinion. But I am inclined to favor the hoax theory. The book Mass Contacts by Stefano Brescia is a strangely incoherent volume filled with absurd claims. It does not display the mind of a scholar and professor. And if the alien visitors described by Brescia really exist, they are not the kind of people I would buy a used car from. According to Brescia, they sometimes give false information, and the result of their activities have been that too many people went mad, and two may have ruined their lives. Earth, an alien enterprise, is difficult to review as there are such a large amount of data, intriguing cases and controversial claims of different quality and credibility. But it certainly is a cliffhanger with lots of suggestions and ideas for the serious ufologist to follow up. I agree with Timothy Good in his assertion that we are not alone on this planet. There are others here, whoever they are,